That's Charlie Mingus with Moanin', a very different arrangement there, but with the same name that is shared with Art Blakey's Moanin', which is a very different tune entirely. Charlie Mingus, of course, on bass, and that is one of his arrangements. He was an extraordinary arranger. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Tuesday, April the 30th. What do you know? And today, it's open forum on Lead Stories, so what you got to say? That's the question today. What do you got to say about issues that you believe are important and warrant closer inspection? So, your number to call is 888-874-4888 to get us started. Don't be shy, and there's no need to panic. But be prepared to defend your point of view. All we're looking for is your considered opinion about something, and you can make your points, and then we see where people pick up from where you leave off. And that's the whole point. I'll tell you, this is as necessary as gathering information and learning about things and hearing other people's opinions. The practice of exchanging information and relaying your own point of view is also very important, very, very important in today's world, because each of us is an influencer one way or the other, not influencer, influenza, but influencer. We influence people's opinions by the strength of our own. And, I find that the right has been pretty adept at this. They in fact, provide, and I've seen talking points on major issues, what you should say if encountered by someone or engaged by someone on subject A or subject B. What is the Republican Party's position on this? But in our own way, we cross paths with people every single day, and one of the good things about it, that kind of interaction is that it is a learning process, and in that process you give and you get. It's a great, great exercise, and we have to become quite used to the idea of exchanging our opinions. This is not to say you agree with everything or you expect people to agree with you, but the interesting thing is the journey a person makes in the process or in the effort at arriving at a considered opinion. What brings you to the point of view that you have? And that's great. So don't be afraid to put forward your ideas, especially the more passionate you are, the more it is expected that you have invested in building that idea, constructing your opinion. So that would be a wonderful thing to do today. These are your airwaves, and this is the room that you deserve, and I really believe this to be part of the work that we must do. We have to exchange ideas. We have to engage each other, and we have to be prepared to, put our thoughts and our opinions through the paces. So 888-874-4888. A couple of things are going on today. In Sanford, Florida, we had George Zimmerman making a court appearance today, and the ruling was that he was not going to put forward a stand your ground defense in his case. He had already waived that right, and today that was made clear that he would not be taking that line of defense in his trial when it comes up on June 10th, when the trial officially begins on that day. But a couple of other things came up and had to do with the demand by the defense that a separate and unrelated, although they say it is related, but a settlement arrived at between the homeowners association where the Trayvon Martin family lived, and the homeowners association had recently settled a lawsuit. The ruling today was that the particulars of that lawsuit are to be made available to Zimmerman's defense. I don't know if that will be appealed, but that was a ruling today. Benjamin Crump, the attorney for the Martin family, had insisted that it was basically a private matter, settled between private parties, and that it had no bearing on the case. And we will see whether it goes through yet another permutation before it gets to trial. So that was the main thing determined today in that hearing, which ended about, I'd say, a good half hour or so ago. So George Zimmerman is not going to take the self-defense tactic line of defense, the stand your ground defense. He's going to go straight as a basic, I don't want to say basic, but a murder trial. It will proceed along as a murder trial. It is going to be a very closely watched trial for all kinds of reasons, and we'll be discussing that. But today was a major last-minute hearing. The defense also got an agreement by the court to allow 5 additional witnesses, although the deadline for witnesses had long since passed. But the court has allowed 5 additional witnesses to be added to the defense list. Well, that's one. There was I don't know what to call it, but the issue continues into this matter in the Boston bombings. And CNN, it was quite troubling today to hear the tone being taken. And the tone was that, it seems as if they are cheerleading. I thought that, they just report the news, but they kind of are part of the news, it seems. The latest wrinkle on this is that, A, the widow of Tamerlan Tsarnaev is supposedly being closely questioned for what she knows about the preparation of bombs or her deceased husband's activities. A very interesting thing about that, though, the media insist on not calling her by her Muslim name, even though, she converted. And it's widespread. It's a very interesting thing. They all call her, Catherine Russell. They never refer to her by her Muslim name, Karima. They refuse to use it. I don't know what that is about, but if you even do a search on her name, you'll have to do a bit of digging even in these very swift electronic times. It seems widespread throughout the media that they absolutely refuse to use her Muslim name. We would not call her by her Muslim name. She is still referred to as Catherine Russell. But supposedly a piece of shrapnel was found, or a piece of the bomb was found, and it had female DNA. This is what CNN is reporting. Of course, all these things come from this, you know, the sources, and the sources are usually the government. It contained female DNA, which they're trying to decipher who belongs to it. The theory is it might even involve Karima and some other female, perhaps who helped to either pack the bomb, or somebody who it may even have been from a victim of the bomb, and they're trying to sort that out. Also, a report came out today, and discussing it as if there's nothing major, you know, to discuss, and that was that they were talking about what the brain of the deceased alleged bomber apparently shows deterioration and brain disease. Now, that is very discomforting on a couple of levels. Number one, I don't know if legally they were entitled to just, you know, I know a postmortem is in order, but I thought that there had to be some legal issues that should have been cleared away first before the harvesting of organs and all of that would have been done. And certainly it would have been done with independent corroboration and oversight. But to make it known, which is, of course, don't forget, we have not left the world of intelligence, okay? We have not left that world. It is coming across as news, but we are people who have gone through media literacy, and we understand what that means. The pervasive view now now is that this shows that, on top of everything else, apart from being a demented jihadist, he may well have been the victim of a deteriorating brain disease by virtue of his boxing career. That's one issue. The bottom line issue to me is we ought to have a conversation about what was the chain of command with the body, and who legally is entitled to this body, who legally is entitled to perform all these things, who is securing the rights of the family, the legal rights of the family. This is a very muddling question, very, very much so. So these things, you see them happening before your eyes and you say, well, this couldn't possibly be, you know, this is not what we're accustomed to. Surely, with all of the fuss being made about Miranda rights and all of the stuff to make sure that everything goes according to the book, there's a pervasive acceptance of some things that should naturally cause, certainly, an information agency, a news agency, to ask the questions rather than to adopt the answers and then you know, just propagate the answers. So we have those questions in mind. And the third thing I wanted to talk about, I just want to mention this just to get things started. We're going to get to the phones in 2 seconds. I did have the occasion, I did not watch the whole thing, but I think I watched way too much of it, and that was the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was a very sad thing indeed. If one looks at environments and pieces things together, you know, had it not been for the fact that he was the president and actually had to be there, and the first lady, his wife, also had to be there, there would be nobody black on the dais. The president was his own, affirmative action at the dinner. He accounted for the black dignitaries sitting on the dais. And it's only because he had to be there. And when the camera panned the room of these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people sitting down in their finery and having din-din and hobnobbing with each other, I looked and they said, wow, I wonder what the Kerner Commission of 1965 would have thought about that room. And the Kerner Commission in 1965, in the aftermath of the tumult of the 60s, had issued this report, basically taking a look at the role of media in creating and maintaining racially bifurcated America. And there was the evidence right before your eyes. It was a mostly white room. Every now and then you see, oh, there's one. Oh, there's another. But for the most part, it was an apartheid event. The newsrooms of America remain very much racially divided. The reporting, therefore, remains very much racially divided. And there we are. It was the most telling lesson to come away with from the great White House correspondence dinner. Well, we'll take your calls now at 888-874-4888. Michael from New York City. How do you do, sir?
Yes, I'm going to digress or go on a tangent from what was being discussed earlier. And I was wondering, how exactly do you even analyze what it is that you're bringing up? I mean, I do know that there was a saying that one of the signs of intelligence is to be able to recognize patterns. But other than that, yeah, I'm pretty much clueless as to how one would go about deciphering what type of book would you even recommend for an individual to go in that direction in terms of drawing some type of conclusion from what is being read?
Well, I don't know that there's a book. I know that it is a matter of training yourself to think differently. And the first thing you want to understand is that news media have a purpose, especially mainstream news media, and in fact all news media, including progressive media, including left media and right media. There are always underlying purposes as they see themselves functioning. And so that attitude permeates in the way they cover the news. Now, the mainstream media is an outgrowth, literally, is an extension of organized society and the power elite of society, that it would tend to reflect those sensibilities. But in any event, no matter what it is you're reading, the point is you have to read. You know how when you're driving, you drive as a defensive driver?
Yeah.
As a consumer of information, you ought to be a defensive consumer of information, no matter where it comes from. And you also should have a natural, you know, your guard should be up on all types of information until you see that you can trust it. You can trust what it says. But I would advise that that's your automatic stance. No matter where the information comes from, you receive the information with your guard up. And then you trust your natural, innate intelligence and your ability to think in a linear fashion. If you see, for example, let's take the example of the correspondence dinner that I said. Now, we've trained each other. We've talked about in as a defensive consumer of information, you look at the environment of the event or issue. What does the physical environment look like? If you do that alone, you come away with, wow, that just does not compute with what we told on the outside about democracy and you know, equality and whatnot. If you just look at it, you just look at the environment in which this thing is happening, and you see Hollywood and you see governmental officials and people from Congress and they're all laughing and having a great time. And you see how that contrasts with the misery going on outside, you come to other conclusions. So you have your own innate ability to analyze things. And what you should be doing is constantly training yourself to observe and to make sense of what you're seeing and compare and contrast that with what supposedly they're selling. They're selling equality. They're selling democracy. Well, that didn't look like a democratic room at all. So that's what I mean. You have a natural ability to put two and two together, and you start training yourself from the very beginning to look at the environment of an issue or event. Okay, and you see, that's your first clue.
That's your first step, okay.
And then you begin to see patterns emerging in things. You see the main topics and you see the patterns emerging about these things. We've talked, for example, even before this, these little news updates are occurring, we talked about in a perceived crisis how media will begin to operate and the cycle. And it's following the cycle, isn't it? So it means that you're armed. So I would just encourage you to trust that you have the innate ability to analyze things, but you must pay attention first. Just start the exercise of training yourself to observe the environment in which an issue or event occurs, and you start making sense of, you know, the event for yourself.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Frank from Maryland.
I just wanted to thank you first because all of the education you're doing in music, in just my background, I'm a professional jazz musician, Grammy-nominated, and a music educator. And I just love the fact that you play such deep music that's sorely missing in the culture these days.
Well, thank you. Thank
being,
you.
Being a part of the Grammy Academy, I was really kind of... I guess the word was dumbfounded when I saw the Grammy show this year. It has its problems, but I'm still a member because I think I can affect it better from the inside. But they did a dedication to Dave Brubeck, and they had these great musicians on, Kenny Garrett and Chris McBride, you know, just great musicians on, to do a dedication to Dave Brubeck. Well, mm-hmm. No sooner than they played the melody of the song, they were off stage. It was a 2-minute dedication to somebody like Dave Brubeck, who's meant so much to jazz music and music in general.
Sure.
And this is one of the problems with this country. It's so steeped in pop music and popular culture, and that no depth comes of anything. And of course, I'm talking about music, but it actually permeates everything we do, even the politics. There's no depth. You know, jazz mm-hmm. is America's music. It's the most ingenious thing culturally we've ever done in terms of music.
It's also something very significant about jazz, and it was in that genre that we found the first, I would call it the most pervasive element of anti-racism.
Exactly.
You know, jazz was just jazz, and everybody played with everybody. You know, all the Latinos and the Afro-Cuban jazz, and the Dave Brubeck, who was just fantastic. And we have a whole bunch of white guys and women who just did so well, so fantastically. And it's a joy to play the music that they created together. It's really incredible.
Exactly. And even from the beginning, if you look at New Orleans, you know, Conga Square, that was a mixture of, hold on just a second.
Are we? We're holding on for Frank. Called away quite quickly to do something. But he's making a point. Oh, we lost him. Sarah from Dallas. Are you on?
Yes, Utrice. Greetings to you and greetings to the listening audience.
Thank you.
You're welcome. On your many topics that you have laid out here, especially with the one with the Tsarnaev brother, the one that you said they took his brain to do a brain study, this is very troubling to me, as you said, because this man is not a U.S. Citizen. He was just a resident. He's still a national of another country. And how can you take it upon yourself to cut somebody's head open and take out their brain to do a brain study without, first of all, getting permission from the wife, since he's a married man, or his mother or whatever, if they agree to it? You see, these are the slippery slopes that we are doing with people as a part of this security apparatus, is to say that we, because somebody's been classified by you as being a so-called terrorist, you therefore want to take their body and do all sorts of things to it in order to prove whatever claim it is you're trying to prove.
Well, not the least of which is that he was a Muslim, and I understand that there are certain rites and rituals that have to be observed in accordance with the religious practices. So there's a lot of stuff going on that, I mean, I didn't hear anybody that raised a question. Well, wait a minute. In such a situation, what technically is supposed to happen? Is there not somebody from, representing the family's legal interests or the family's religious interests who should be apprised that this is what is going on? And in so far as this would eventually end up being a legal matter, should they not have their own observer at this proceeding when a postmortem is conducted? Because we have no idea what's going on now in the chain of command with the body.
Even if it's his brain, Utrice, because, as you said, I've lived in several countries with Muslims. You have a certain time frame. First of all, the body is not desecrated like that. Regardless of what circumstances he died under, you're supposed to get all the body and put it back together as intact as possible to bury it with all of the organs. You cannot perform an autopsy and take out a brain, especially touching up the head, because in most Muslim countries or in most Eastern religion, it's forbidden for you to touch people on their heads. And what they have done with this man, and as I said, he has a wife, they would have to get her permission. And as you said, I did not know that was the woman's Muslim name, because they kept putting in Kathleen Russell. They kept repeating it in the papers as what was her born name, which shows a lack of respect, because if we recall with Muhammad Ali, they did the same thing to him. They kept calling him Cassius Clay, and he kept saying his name is Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are the things that you pick up. And, as I was talking with Michael from New York City, these are the natural indications that you latch onto, and you say, well, this doesn't sound right. And you now listen to subsequent reports about this to see how routinely they report these irregularities, as if to say, hey, there's no problem here. But I tell you, it is also a signal about the media's intent and the media's role as supporter of whatever it is the government tells them to say. They just say it and do it because they believe that is their patriotic role as media. Yeah. They absolutely refuse. I have not seen a single story in which Karima is referred to as Karima and not Kathleen. Catherine Russell.
Exactly, because I was looking through the papers myself when they first said she was married and she converted, and they kept calling her by her name. It's as if though what they're trying to say is that, okay, she is a white American. We're not going to associate her with these two brothers who are a foreign national, and they're linked to Islam and Muslim and possible terrorism. We're going to try, and, it's the same thing with this John Walker Lind person, the white young man who was found in Afghanistan, as they call him, the American Taliban. They did everything that they could to disassociate him from being Muslim and being a so-called terrorist, as they call. They tried to separate him from that crowd. And that's the same thing that they always try to do with someone who is okay, white, and they're involved in whatever religious group. They try to separate them. But with these brothers and with everyone else, we're going to go ahead and just throw you all in this pot together, and we're going to give you one big label.
Well, I'll say it as bluntly as could possibly be said. The implication is that they see her as a form of not just a race traitor, to coin the old term, but she's also a religion traitor. Mm-hmm. She should not have betrayed her good Christian roots. You know, that's the implicit message from the media. Thanks, Sarah, for your contribution today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Patrice.
Thank you. We're moving on to Michael of New Jersey. Michael, are you there?
I'd like to bring up, but first I'd like to apologize in advance to your listeners for referencing David Brooks's column in the New York Times today. But I...
Apology accepted, thank you.
Okay, but here's the thing. You know, politically, I'm not, you know, I sometimes refuse to read them, but I read the column today, and it really struck a note, but it's very superficial. But it's a looks like a starting point for really digging into something that's very significant. And I don't know if you looked at it today, but it...
No, I was going to say I haven't, but could you tell us what was said?
Well, he goes on about the difference between an engaged writer and a detached writer. And I'll just read a little bit. My reading isn't so good, but the engaged writer closely and intimately aligns with a team. In his writing, he provides arguments for the party faithful and builds community by reminding everyone of the errors and villainy of the opposing side. For the engaged writer, the writer is often not about persuasion. The writing isn't about persuasion. Realistically, how many times does a piece of writing persuade somebody to switch sides, in parentheses? It's often about mobilization. It's about energizing the people you already agree with who already agree with you. The engaged writer often will criticize his own party, but from a zone of trust inside it. And he usually advises the party to return to its core creed. The engaged writer is willing to be repetitive because that's how you make yourself an unavoidable pole in the debate. The goal is to have immediate political influence to provide party leaders with advice, strategy, and policy recommendations. I won't bore you with this too much, but I have to go to the other side. Now, the detached writer also has a worldview. If you don't have a philosophical worldview, your essays won't even rise to the status of being wrong. They won't be anything. But the detached writer wants to be a few steps away from the partisans. She is progressive, but not democratic, conservative, but not Republican. She fears the team mentally will blinker her views. She wants to remain mentally independent because she sees politics as a competition between partial truths. She wants to remain mentally independent because she sees, competition is partial. I'm reading on the computer, I'm afraid. And she wants the liberty to find the proper balance between them, issue by issue. The detached writer believes that writing is more like teaching than activism. Her essays are generally not about winning short-term influence. Realistically, how many times can an outside writer shape the short-term strategies of a political insider? She would rather have an impact upstream, shaping people's perceptions of underlying reality and hoping that she can provide a context in which other people can think. She sometimes gets passionate about her views, but she distrusts her passions. She takes notes with emotion, but aims to write with regulated sobriety.
Ooh.
So he's explaining the detached writer and the engaged writer. Now,
does the paragraph relating to the bought and sold writer, the compromised writer?
Well, yes, I think the engaged writer would we would describe in those terms.
You cited this to make a point, but you didn't make your point yet. What is it? You told us about the detached and the engaged.
I think most of the press and the writers out there are engaged, and they're engaged because they want to join a team, and I think they join a team because there's security in that.
Let me tell you something. Don't fall for any of this. You know, there is implicit power in the ability to define things and name things and have them have meaning. Exactly what is going on with you in reading this, you now fall into the same science of persuasion, where people exert power without you even knowing it. And they exert the power by telling you there's a thing called the detached writer and the engaged writer. And now it's supposed to be educating us about the different types of writers. There's no such thing. There's no such thing. You either have integrity as a writer or you don't. But the power to define things is an extraordinary thing.
That's right. Because
it shakes your universe. Because right now, you know, you just read this, and it sounds all nice and flowery and scientific. Well, he doesn't know diddly about the detached writer or the engaged writer. He doesn't know the difference because he's working at the New York Times. And the New York Times has played the largest role in the racial bifurcation of America. Both detached and engaged writers did it. So he needs to take a look around the newsroom of the New York Times, which, by the way, has been systematically emptied of its African-American writers. And he needs to find out what happened there. They're gone writers. Is there a paragraph about gone and disappeared writers? No. So when you see these people rise to a level, it's an expression of their own test of their power. The power to define, the power to define reality, the power to name things, the power to give authenticity to a totally bogus idea of the detached writer and the engaged writer. What kind of nonsense is that? It makes him sound good, but really, when you look at it, it is as significant as a fly on the butt of an elephant. Really, it is. There's no science to it. It's just that this guy feels so important. He's now going to educate the public about the two types of writers there are.
Well, this is the way I always feel about his column, really. It brings up the ire and the bile in one.
Yes, but you know, it also illustrates a very important point, and don't diminish the importance of it. And that is, in our everyday reading and consuming of information, we end up with people who just situate themselves as authorities on things. And you dare not question their authority because they use the right words, multisyllabic words and deep insights and what. It's hogwash. But it comes with the imprimatur of the New York Times, and here he is a columnist, so he must be smart.
He must be deeply
visionary, and he's sharing his lofty ideas in this stellar, the gray lady, as they call the newspaper. But in the end, he's simply exercising that empty authority that many people have, or they think they have, and that is to define your reality for you by naming things, by defining things. And now, any reader who approaches that, and this goes to you, back to you, Michael of New York City, exactly the point I was telling you about. When this information is coming from the New York Times, a source of, quote, authority on things, a great venerable institution with really educated people writing, but look what they do. They presume, they have the arrogance to presume that they can define for you and define for anybody reality. This guy just comes out of nowhere and comes up with a theory of two types of writers. There may be 500 kinds, but you may only know two. You know, it's like this, from time to time you hear these reports, scientists have discovered a new species of frog. It's not new to the frog. The frog has been there for how long? Hundreds and millions of years. It's new to you. But simply because it's new to you doesn't make it new, you see? But this is what they do. So you have to be defensive. The first thing you say is, oh my gosh, the presumption, the arrogance of these people to write this way. Now, it's one thing to say, you know, if he could have said that he notices these kinds of attributes in certain kinds of writing. But don't come out and tell me there are two types of writers. You're off the wall. That's one kind of jerk. How's that?
But if you have the time, you should read it from top to bottom.
I won't bother. I'll place categories first and learn something.
Okay.
Thank you so much, Ron.
You're welcome.
Clarence from the Bronx, how you doing
today? Hello, Dietrich. I love your show. I tried to call. I don't call all the time because I like to listen to what you have to say. You, Gary Noel, and you had Stanley Letman on yesterday, and he's like so on the money. I want to hear what he had to say.
Well, you'll hear him tomorrow again. He'll be with us tomorrow.
Yeah, that's my boy. I love him. If I don't get you guys live like today, I'll listen to you on archives because. I got called once before about the mass media, and I think that I don't read nothing in the Times. Like, Stanley Letman is where I get my information from, stuff guys like you and stuff like that, because the New York Times are sold out, bought out. You can't believe nothing that they say. They got us into a phony war. This country has lied so much about so many things. You know, when you talking about the guys, you know, in Boston, you got to think about President Kennedy. That's the last time we had a president to try to be a president. What happened to him? He got murdered in Dallas, and that story never came out. The truth about that never been told. It's all kinds of, you know, grassy knoll, but we do know it was more than one shooter, and we do know that Oswald didn't do it. But we just couldn't prove it. And I was a kid when that happened.
You said McKinley. You meant Kennedy.
Kennedy. Right. Okay. I meant to say Kennedy. I'm a little nervous, because I got so much to say. But the mass media is so crooked. It's such a lying thing. It's such a racist thing. They don't tell the truth about nothing. Whatever they say, and I listen to them, I have to laugh. I watch it sometimes for just entertainment, not for information. Because CNN, all those guys are so out of touch with reality. So...
Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Okay, example of what I'm talking about. Okay. Example. So many. Let me see which one you want to go back years ago or now or kind of like
You pick it.
Okay, I'll pick a good one. Let me see All right, let me see now. So much. Where can I start? Okay, Libya. Let's talk with Libya. That's Stanley Letman. I learned a lot about Libya. All we talked about Libya was that, Gaddafi was a bad man. We had to go over there and kill him. He was the worst. He was going to drop bombs on America. He was going to do all these bad things. But they never talked about what he did good, how good he was for his own country. The people in Libya didn't pay to go to school. But we have problems here where people can't even go to school. They had to pay so much money. In Libya, they had the highest, it's called the Human Development Index. It's in the UN. What country has you can develop your human skills to the highest potential. And Libya had the highest of all the African countries. They weren't in debt. People were earning money. Now look at the country. Look at the country. They don't talk about that on the news. They don't talk about Iraq. Look at Iraq. The people can't go to school. They don't have water. They don't have electricity. They don't have they don't talk about the Congo, Africa. The people in Africa. Look what happened in Nigeria. The Nigeria right now. People in Nigeria are starving, dying. But Shell Oil is over there. Making lots of money. People are living in poverty. And we talk about the down in New Orleans and the PP where my family's from down there, where the oil spill. They're in Africa every day. They live with oil spills. And they should be rich. The people don't have water. They don't have anything. The news will talk about that.
Now,
no talk about anything about right here in our own country. The kids are dying like dogs in the street, and they don't talk about that.
Now, Clarence, I want to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
So you know what they're not doing. How did you know the other side of it? How did you get to the other side of the story?
I listen to the other side of what story?
The same stories you're talking about. You
talked
about Libya.
Well, anything that they say is opposite.
How did you get
my indicators to go the other way. If they say go north, I go south.
But how did you?
It's in the mass media. It's the opposite.
Right,
and the guys
but
in
I'm
Boston,
asking you.
You know there were FBI agents all over that. If they couldn't have the Black Panthers, you know they're going to and listen, in this country, when you're white, you can get away with doing a lot of different stuff.
But Clarence, I'm asking because it's going to be an educational thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How did you arrive?
Mm-hmm.
Where did you get the information as to the contrary? You know, you pointed out how the media covered a particular event or many events.
That's
how did you get to the other side of the coin?
Well, how do I get to the other side of the point? Opening my eyes and looking at what's going on around. I grew up in New York City and I've seen the news from my perspective, but I know what really happened. And I hear the news on the news story. I said, that is not what happened. That's not what happened now. I was there. I seen what happened. The news is our liars. Let me call them scandal media. The only news I listen to is you, Dutrice. Gary Noel.
Wow.
Look at Gary Noel. If Gary Noel had a church and I go to every Sunday, I would be there every Sunday worshiping Gary Noel, the church of Gary Noel. That's how much I love Gary Noel. And Stanley Levin, too. But Gary Noel is the man. But besides the point of that, you have other Gary Noel. I came to Gary Noel through a long, long trip. I used to listen to all the radio shows. I like the news. I used to listen to CNN and all these different guys. And slowly through Democracy Now, I came around to the progressive because I was going crazy. I thought I was bugging out. I listened to people like Randy Rose. She's out of touch with reality. I thought she knew what she was talking about. And Bill O'Reilly. I actually listened to those people a couple years back because I didn't have nobody to listen to. And slowly but surely, I found you people. And you have people talking about.
But what you're saying really goes back.
Guy was saying, hello. Excuse me. I'm sorry.
What you're saying goes back to the point from the first caller, Michael, and you're talking about being defensive and seeking out alternative points of view. I mean, even with right here on PRN, mm-hmm. I mean, I still advise you to be very careful.
I do.
The point is, information, wherever it comes from, you want to evaluate it for its integrity.
True. You're right.
You know,
right.
I'm glad that you find that you know there's a difference to the quality of the information that you get here. But I'm saying no matter where the information comes from, it always will have some kind of contradiction.
Well,
so you want to be defensive.
Okay, I'm sorry to cut you off. I apologize. I could never cut you off.
No, Clarence, I love talking to you. I mean, you're so animated. That's great. But
no,
you know what I like?
You know,
I'll tell you what I like. I'll tell you what I like about what you've said. I like the fact that you are intuitive about the news and information because you sense that what is being said is not quite matching up with the reality. And you know what the reality is. In some cases, you witnessed it yourself. But in other cases, you have sought out alternative avenues of information that allow you to make sense of the initial information that was presented to you. So you now have two different points of view. And you gravitate to the point that makes sense. So that says to me you are a defensive consumer of information, which is exactly what I think is the ideal. You want people to consume information defensively and selectively. And that's what you're doing. That's the story you're telling me. That's what I'm getting. Are you there?
Oh, hello?
Yes, I said that's the story you're telling me, and that's what I'm relating to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited about that.
Well, I just see that the news, they suppress stuff. They don't give you the real thing. And if people are, first of all, we don't get a good education. So the people are like, like dumbed out. They don't know anything, so they can't. They don't know where to get the news from anyway. They don't know where to go, and they believe what they see on TV. And that's how you control people through mass media. That's what they had. That's how Castro was able to get over. They didn't have radios and TV, so he's able to talk to the people like with speeches. And that was his way he was able to communicate to the people. When you can't talk to the people the right way, they get miscommunication, misinformation, all kinds of psychops and, you know, lies, and tell them anything. So that's what's
very
going
good.
On. So to me, the news is, don't believe what you hear in the news. It's entertainment. It's not the truth. You won't get it from none of those, you know, you might get it from the Russian news, RT. They're not so bad. But the American news media is a joke. I watch it and laugh. It's like watching a
thank you, Clarence. I want to get one more call before we go.
Okay, I'm sorry, Patrice. I just listened to your show today.
No. I really love your call. I really love talking with you today. Thank you so much. Willie from Brooklyn.
Good afternoon, beloved. How are you?
Hello. Fine. Thank you, Willie.
I love that brother. He's good. I really like listening to him. He's very good. Well, Patrice, you know, I got started with this thing in 1990. I knew something was wrong with what they were saying on television. You know, I used to listen to CNN and stuff like that. And I'm saying, there's something wrong with this picture. Everybody's saying the same thing. And I came across WBAI and came across UNWBAI. And ever since then, I got rid of television. I just don't watch it anymore. Because, you know, I don't like lies and deception. I hate lies. And another good source is Minister Farrakhan. Because, you know, I've been listening for 20 years. And you may say anything you want to say about him, but you cannot say he's a liar. And whatever comes out of his mouth is researched by the Nation of Islam Research Department. So whatever
I tell
you hear,
I would say, really, even with Minister Farrakhan.
Wait, you two, stop.
Don't take what he says for granted either.
Stop. I have listened to him for 20 years. Not one word. I mean, I have tapes upon tapes. Not one. I found him alive. Not one. And you'd have to show me a tape, or give me a tape, and let me check it out.
No, I'm saying, no matter where the information comes from,
uh-huh.
All information in the end has some idea of educating, informing, or persuading.
Yes.
So, no matter where the information comes from,
uh-huh.
No matter the source,
yes,
you look at it as a defensive consumer of information.
Well, it's truthfully, you know, like I was saying, you know, they've said many, many things of that brother. One thing they've never said, he's a liar. No one has ever said that. Why? You show me where he lies. And this is why I love listening to him. And he did a thing on the United Nations. With Gaddafi, that brother could get the information on the work that Gaddafi does for his people and the African people all over the world, as a matter of fact. You see, but you and like you said, with Gary, no, and you, we got it. I love both you guys. Enjoy.
Well, thank you.
Enjoy. Be safe.
Thanks so much, Willie. Thanks for your call today. Well, the topic today is, as it turns out, is be careful of the information you get and that you incorporate into your reservoir, your working reservoir of knowledge. Because nothing is 100% perfect. There is intent. There are all kinds of contradictions to watch out for, lots of pitfalls, lots of agendas hidden and absolutely staring in your face. But you be careful about the information you consume. And again, going back to the wonderful discussion with, I think, Michael from New Jersey. No, it was Ron, about the New York Times. When people speak from a position of authority, especially when they do, the reflex action is simply to, you know, just basically inhale everything that is said. And you have to be very, especially careful because, again, they're functioning from a position, the implicit authority that they have over your mind And your mind is the one thing that the entire world is fighting for. That nice piece of real estate between your ears called your brain. Everybody wants it. And they're fighting like crazy to lay claim to it. And it is the one thing that you ought to be prepared to fight for, and that is the integrity of your own mind and your own thoughts. So that brings us to the end of our program today. Thanks so much. Tomorrow, we go back to business. This, by the way, is exactly what we need to do. Throw out all of your opinions into the boiling cauldron and see what develops. I want to thank you so much for trusting or entrusting your thoughts with me today and sharing them with others. And pass the word on. Let people know this is your stop at 1 o'clock every day, Monday through Friday. See you mañana. Bye-bye.